This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. I'm thrilled today to be joined by Susan Dentzer. Susan is a healthcare policy guru. She's one of the best known policy people in healthcare. She currently runs as senior policy fellow at the Duke Margolin Center for Healthcare Policy, but she's done amazing things throughout her remarkable career and still doing them. Susan, can you take a moment to introduce yourself? Then we'll talk to you about vaccines, about public options, Medicare for All, rural and urban hospitals, and a lot more. Susan?
Scott, first of all, it's great to be with you. Thanks so much for having me. And yes, as you said, I'm a senior policy fellow at the Duke Margolis Center. We're the arm of Duke University. We're actually based in Washington, D.C., but we bring together all the people across the university who care about healthcare and health policy. Right now, of course, we're doing a lot of work on the pandemic with some really important papers and perspectives on vaccine development, on diagnostic testing for COVID, et cetera. My prior life before I got to Duke Margolis 2 years ago was I'm a recovering journalist. I spent many years in print journalism as well as television. I spent a decade as a health correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. I then was recruited away to lead the journal Health Affairs, which I did for 5 years, and then went to be the senior policy advisor for the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. I took a little bit of a diversion to run a small nonprofit focused on health innovation, and then came here to the Margolis Center. So it's been a really interesting, different ride, and always with an eye to bringing health policy to the point that it really could be understood and grasped by all of us who care very deeply about it and need to know about it and figure out how we get to a better healthcare system for ourselves and our families.
Well, you've done a remarkable job. I followed you for a long time. I've heard you speak in person a number of times. Take one moment on how, just 60 seconds, how you transformed the Journal of Health Affairs, because it really was a monumental task of taking a great publication but making it much more user-friendly for everybody on a very deep subject. You did a magnificent job on that. Then I want to talk to you about vaccines, when we're going to have them, Medicare for All, public options, are we going to have them, what that's going to look like, and more, whether for it or against it. I want to hear where it's going and a lot more. Susan, 60 seconds on the Journal of Health Affairs and the transformation that you undertook.
Well, of course, the journal was launched by my predecessor, John Iglehart, who did a fabulous job bringing it to the public. I did think we could kick health affairs up a few notches when I took over. So among other things we did is we converted from being a bi-monthly journal that came out six times a year to being a monthly journal that came out, of course, every month. We redesigned the journal physically so it looked a lot more appealing visually. We pretty much, I would say, diversified our audience of authors. We reached out more broadly into other communities that had not traditionally been contributing to health affairs. I put a real premium on making those articles as understandable as possible. The baseline I set was that anybody who had a college education could read through a health affairs article without stumbling over a lot of academic jargon or sentences that didn't make sense or what have you. That was quite an uphill battle. A lot of academics don't write so well. I'm here to break that news to people. So there was a lot that went into the transformation, but the most important thing is, too, I think we came about at a time where interest in healthcare was about to really soar. It was right just shortly before the election of Barack Obama and the introduction of the legislation that led to the Affordable Care Act. And because we had made all these changes, we're seizing the potential of the internet. We had launched a blog that was able to be much more timely than even a peer-reviewed journal could be. We were able to really rise to meet the demand for information about health policy at a really, really important time and do it in a way that was really much more oriented to people who needed to know about health policy but weren't necessarily getting their needs met through more academic journals.
Well, you did a wonderful job with that. I want to ask you two other questions. So let me give you about 60 seconds a question, 90 seconds a question, and I'll ask you follow-up questions on vaccines. I know you've been doing some studying and working and looking at vaccines as part of your work. 60, 90 seconds on when can we expect a vaccine? What should we worry about? How excited should we be? Will this just be a spread reducer versus a total solution? What's your sense of vaccines and how quickly?
Well, the easy answer to all of those questions is we don't know yet. But the best guess is that we will have at least one effective, if not more than one effective vaccine somewhere between the fourth quarter and the first quarter of this year. We will find out how effective that is. You know, the threshold for effectiveness right now is that a vaccine could be approved by the FDA if for every three people that get vaccinated, only one person develops severe COVID. So that's, you know, not the highest threshold of effectiveness, but it tells you what the baseline could be. So somewhere, as I
said, that's very similar to the flu vaccine. That's not some crazy standard. That's like the flu vaccine. The flu vaccine works for maybe 40-50% of people, but it helps reduce flu and maybe makes it less severe in people. So that's not a bad thing. I mean, it's not great. We'd love it to be 100% effective, but that's not realistic.
No, it's not a bad thing to have a vaccine that is even that effective. It's a little different, I think, from what a lot of people are expecting. My only point is that we're going to get something probably out that is at least that effective in the next 6 months or so. And then, of course, we begin the really hard job of dispersing it broadly throughout the population.
And let me ask you another question, sort of Medicare for All, public option, expanded Medicaid. What's your sense of what's coming? And again, let me ask you for a short answer, and then I'll ask you follow-up questions on that, too.
Sure. Well, of course, we're on the eve of the national elections, and if the White House does change hands, and if Vice President Biden does become the president, it's very clear we can expect a public option proposal at least to be floated probably by the administration at some point over the course of the coming year. Where that goes in the Congress, of course, remains to be seen and is, of course, heavily dependent on whether the Democrats also take the Senate if, in fact, Biden is elected president. Because unless that's the case, it's hard to imagine the current makeup of the Senate approving a public option. But who knows? Who knows?
I mean, let me ask you a question about the public option. A public option seems to me like the concept that you can't deny insurance with a pre-existing condition, meaning that 80% of all Americans, regardless of political stripe, would ultimately like a public option, particularly if it doesn't blow up the budget and cause crazy tax rates. I mean, people generally would like a public option, regardless of political stripe. Isn't that your sense?
Well, I will say this. We don't have a concrete public option proposal to look at very closely at this point. What we have are some proposals that have been put forward in the Congress. What I think the Biden folks are talking about, public option, would be another option that would be available within the Affordable Care Act exchanges. And the main notion of it is that it would pay providers rates that are closer to Medicare rates than is the case with the other ACA plans, which are, in the end, commercial plans that are paying higher rates and therefore will be more affordable. And so that's the essence of the public option as it is being put forward. And, of course, the payment would come from the federal government in terms of large subsidies, but we can't rule out that there wouldn't be private paying into that option as well.
Yeah, so let me ask you a question. The exchanges the exchanges seem to have been a compromise way of dealing with the fact that it was hard for President Obama to get all the votes he needed to either provide a public option to Medicare or just expand Medicaid. Wouldn't it be simpler if we had a public option to just buy insurance through Medicare if you're below 65, then work with these exchanges, which seem to be so challenging for everybody? What is your sense of that?
Well, Biden has a separate proposal to lower the Medicare eligibility age to 60. So, and it's not clear at this point how these two ideas coexist, the public option and a lower Medicare eligibility age. But so in theory, people 60 and over who wanted to buy into Medicare would have the ability to do that. We don't know exactly what the subsidy structure would look like at this point, but that would be one piece of it. And then other people below age 60 who wanted a more affordable option and needed to obtain it through the individual insurance market would buy the public option on an exchange. So that's the more or less the vision that Biden has set forth. Again, whether any of this can come about is very, very heavily dependent on the makeup of the Congress.
Fascinating. So we've talked about vaccines, we've talked about expanded Medicare or public option or whatever it might be. In 60-90 seconds, Susan, what are the one or two other most interesting issues that you're thinking about or looking at today?
Well, I think, you know, the pandemic, to state the obvious, has just reminded us all over again what some of the both strengths and the weaknesses of the work system are. And we see the strengths every day and the heroic levels of care that are being provided to individuals throughout the country who have COVID and other conditions amid the pandemic. On the other hand, we also see the enormous disparities we have in the underlying health status of the population. We see that we haven't fully addressed the social drivers of poor health in the population. We see the fact that we're having losses of health insurance coverage right now, partly due to rising rates of unemployment, et cetera, et cetera. So we've got to refocus our attention on all of those issues. We've got to do a better job of creating a viable public health system, which has essentially in many parts of the country been in tatters. We're going to have to come back at the issue of health insurance coverage and offer these, whether it's a public option or whatever it is, even just shoring up the ACA, making sure that people have a path to coverage if they do lose their jobs and other sources of coverage. So that's first and foremost. And then the final thing is we know our system is unaffordable and unsustainable, and we've got to continue to deal with the costs of it. And so thinking about new ways to transform the delivery system to make it more cost effective and also to pay in a different way than we've been doing historically through fee-for-service, we have to continue to push on all of that.
Well, and let me ask you another question. There's been this huge evolution towards dominant and elite health systems and very important to our ecosystem, whether the Mayo Clinics, the Cleveland Clinics, the large regional systems, the Atriums, the Northwells, and so forth, very, very important to our ecosystem. But the rural health hospitals and the urban hospitals that are not the dominant systems in the academic medical centers end up in trouble, the rural and the urban hospitals. Are there any solutions for those other than being more streamlined or having a great purpose or greater subsidies to stay as larger hospitals? Or should they be more streamlined? What's the answer on some of the rural issues in the urban hospitals that aren't the great academic medical centers but are very important to communities? Any answers on that in a quick sense on that issue?
Well, we are, of course, in the midst of a rural health crisis, both a health crisis and a health care crisis in rural areas. And I think I have joked, kind of sadly joked about, we had the famous Hill Burton program that built a lot of hospitals across the country after World War II. We need a new wave Hill Burton program that doesn't necessarily build hospitals, but it builds health care, particularly in rural communities, in the kind of structure that those communities now really need. Maybe some of them still need 25-bed critical access hospitals, but they also need a lot more. They need effective EMS systems, right, that can get care into people's homes. They need investment to do telehealth. They need to be able to hire lots of community health workers. I think we've got to rethink our current structure of providing healthcare in rural communities, which is doing the best it possibly can under the circumstances. But it it needs to be brought forward into the 21st century, and we can do that and improve health in rural areas. As for urban hospitals, you know, it's very clear that we're going to need to invest in some of our our urban hospitals that have been on the short end of the stick, our safety net hospitals that are largely dependent on low Medicaid rates, et cetera, et cetera. So we've got to do a real serious think in this country about where we need hospital capacity, where we don't need more hospital capacity, and where we need to beef up what we've got now. And that, I think, is going to be a challenge for our country, because historically we've had fallen in and out of love with the notion of healthcare planning. But I don't see how, if only on a state or regional basis, we can't come back to this notion of where do we need to have access, where do we have access problems now, and how can we best deal with them? And again, we've got a lot of new ways to do that via telehealth and other ways of getting health closer to people in their homes and communities that we can take advantage of in this environment.
Thank you. And Susan, give us 30 seconds on the new podcast that you're hosting.
Absolutely. I've been partnering with Optum, which of course is the part of the United Health Group that gathers together a lot of the health services capacities across the Optum family of companies, to really essentially look in various ways, mostly to do, or a lot to do, I should say, with technologies to reach the goals of the quadruple aim. And because Optum is not just a part of the United Health Group, which of course has its own health insurance plans within it, Optum is also dealing with the entire rest of the market. So the company has a kind of 360-degree view of the healthcare system, because it's partnering with all different aspects of the healthcare system. So what we're trying to do with this podcast is get inside some of the core issues of healthcare that don't get a ton of attention but are really, really important, like the fact that we have huge administrative costs in healthcare in the U.S. that we probably could reduce if we brought to bear a lot of technologies, including artificial intelligence, for example, and put that tool to work addressing some of the issues. So what we're trying to do is really get to the nub of some of the issues that get in the way of people getting the right care at the right time, in the right place, at the right cost, and what how we can use the tools that a company like Optum, and Optum isn't alone here. There are lots of competitors in this field too, thank goodness, because we need everybody working on these issues. But basically framing the possibilities to deal with some of these issues and, as I say, achieve the goals of the quadruple aim.
Fantastic, Susan. A great pleasure visiting with Susan Dentzer today, magnificent healthcare policy guru. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Scott. It was a pleasure to be with you.